Welcome to the CRE Podcast, 100% Canadian, 100% commercial real estate. Now, here are your hosts, Aaron Cameron and Adam Pawatic.
Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Podcast powered by First National. I'm Aaron Cameron. With me, of course, Adam Pawatic. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Granite REIT, as part of this video speaker series that we are recording live at Real REIT. Our guest today, and again, for the uncounted time, I don't know many times, Jim Costello, MSCI, Chief Economist of Real Asset Team. Hi, Jim. How you doing?
Great.
I had fourth, fifth, sixth time, and I can't remember how many times I had Jim on, and that's on purpose. Jim travels the world talking about real estate and tracks capital flows and has a sort of an in-depth understanding of just kind of how we're all, our industry, commercial real estate is interconnected to lots of different things. And so Jim always brings a very interesting perspective to our podcast. And so we like to have him on as many times as we possibly can. Today being one of those times, given just what's transpiring in the marketplace with interest rates up and future potential recession and all sorts of valuation challenges with real estate and, you know, all sorts of different things. So we're going to try to keep this conversation centered around sort of macroeconomic trends and the impact on real estate. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Okay, cool. Before we go there, for those that aren't familiar, why don't we just do a quick commercial on MSCI?
It's an interesting company. They bought the company I was with in 2001. The company I was with was Real Capital Analytics. We tracked commercial real estate sales and the pricing, the terms at which people did stuff worldwide. But MSCI, they have a much broader business looking at all types of investments, helping pension funds, 401ks, any type of investor understand the performance that they're looking at. So they build all these indexes on equity market performance. They had an interest in moving into more a private asset world because, you know, people saw the writing on the wall. Everything isn't just the stock market these days. People are investing in private companies, not just real estate, but private companies broadly. So the company's been making an effort to get more performance metrics around private companies. And that's meant buying companies that are tracking that information. They bought a company, IPD, in 2012. That's an investment property data bank. And they create an index here in Canada with RealPAC on the performance of real estate. Just a couple of weeks ago, they bought a company, Burgess, that tracks the interests in private companies and the returns there. And so it's just part of a broader strategy to create an all-encompassing set of metrics for investment to help people understand the risks and opportunities that are out there.
So they act as a consulting firm, ultimately, with these indices?
It's an information firm. Really, the business is focused around creating tools around data and putting it in the hands of asset managers and investors to help them run their businesses better, to help them do their jobs better.
So decision-making support.
Exactly.
At a global level for difficult to get information.
First time we met Jim, he was saggy-eyed and tired because he had just gotten off a red-eye from Korea. That was pre-pandemic. Post-pandemic, we've talked to Jim multiple times from his apartment in Brooklyn. Where have you been recently?
Let's see. Recently, I have not been back to Korea yet. This summer, the last trip I made before the summer break was to Amsterdam. And I spoke at a conference there and then saw a bunch of our clients there. There's a number of big asset managers in Amsterdam. Great city. Really easy to get around because...
Get on a bike?
Well, I did later in the trip for some personal stuff. I took some vacation time on that one and did a three-day ride through the Dutch countryside on a road bike and just left my luggage with a service that delivered to my place every day. That was fun. But it was also great. Just you're in central Amsterdam and you hop on a train and then you're suddenly in The Hague and you're visiting with clients and you hop on another train and you're off in another little area. So it's a nice multinodal kind of
wait. Area. You can transfer yourself from city to city without using a car.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, I know. Really, that's very unlike a lot of places in North America, but it was quick and easy and people were commuting like that. It was pleasant, but I was there visiting with those asset managers. This year, the rest of my travel is mostly focused on the U.S. and Canada. It's been a couple trips to Toronto. Later in the year, I go to Vancouver again. Back here in the fall, of course, for the Global Forum. But the same kind of questions are coming up wherever I'm at. You know, people are asking questions about, you know, valuation issues, what's happening, how much further will prices go down, what forces are driving it all. So, you know, whether you're in Toronto, LA, New York, Amsterdam, London, they're all asking the same kind of questions.
Aaron's got a question on valuations, and we are at the Real REIT conference. So this is a topical in Canada. The REIT's trading at a discount to NAV. but Aaron claims it's false because the values are overstated. Do you have an opinion on this?
Well, don't put that on me. That's Adam's question.
There's been a lot of talk about REITs in this, since 2020, about what signals are the REIT market throwing off that will provide an insight for the private assets. And early on in 2020, REIT prices, the share component, the price component of the index is cratered. There was a big voice out there at the time, a lot of folks saying that, private markets are going to have to follow immediately. But they never did. Prices were just kind of flat and didn't really respond in the same way. And realistically, they shouldn't have cratered because we responded. The Bank of Canada, the Federal Reserve Bank, Bank of England, every major central bank, every government around the world flooded the markets with liquidity. And you have that much liquidity coming in, there's no reason that the asset prices should fall. Anybody who wanted a loan could get a loan. There was forbearance on everything. It was sort of a don't upset the ship, just play along and see what happens, and then we'll make decisions later. And so with all that liquidity, within a year, the REITs, the signal came through, prices went up, private market assets, prices continued to climb again. And then we get to 2021, 2022, when inflation was starting to kick in and interest rates are going up, and then it all changed. There, REIT prices fell, and I think it was a realistic fall of the REIT prices at that time because suddenly the cost of borrowing became so much higher. The corporate bond market, we saw an increase in the cost of debt there. REITs, they use some mortgage debt, but they use a lot of corporate balance sheet borrowing. And so what's happened to the corporate bond market is a very important thing to think about their values. And if that's going up, then the value of the companies is down a bit because it's just how you finance it matters. So the private market, maybe about a year later, started to show signs of declines. People were loath to take losses if nobody was forcing them. And so owners were holding off for higher prices. And that's really why deal volume cratered, because buyers were pricing everything as if, pricing to every worst case scenario on the future income growth and, the cost of financing. And current owners, they just didn't want to take a loss like that. So they held off as long as they could. But we're starting to see some cracks appear, a growing sense of distress and more challenges on that point.
On this net asset value conversation, particularly for REITs, we're at real REITs, there's a reluctance to adjust the asset value. How do you perceive that? Like what kind of, in my mind, I just got like, it inevitably has to occur, does it not? And this sort of discount to NAV then becomes kind of a false narrative because that NAV is just inaccurate.
For the private markets, there's definitely been a hesitancy to adjust asset values there. When signals were coming out from the REIT market and from the corporate bond market and returns and other asset classes, when all that was coming down, appraisers were kind of stuck. They're looking at this and they're thinking, okay, how do I make sense of this? I don't see anything else trading because deal volume's down, because nobody wants to be that person at the forum 5 years from now where everybody's like, hey, remember that fellow who bought everything at the high prices at the very end of the last cycle? What industry is he in now? Nobody wants that reputational risk. Nobody wants to be that person. And so deal volume held off. And so the appraisers were kind of stuck with fewer comparable sales to look at. And, there's a sense of caution there. I don't want to move it too much because what if we have another one of these situations where there's more support in the future? And honestly, early in 2023 at a conference in Florida, the CREFC conference, the CMBS market, it's a real big conference in the United States where all the CMBS lenders and borrowers get together. People were honestly talking about interest rates moving back down to the levels we saw in 2020 and 2021. As an economist, I think of that as, that made me laugh when I first heard people saying that stuff, because the only scenario I see that gets us back to those kind of situations is an economic slowdown of such severity that all the central banks start easing again. And in my mind, that's not something to hope for. You want good economic growth. A little higher interest rate, that's a sign of some demand in the economy. That's a sign of growth. And the thought of just going back to a weak economy, that's really what it gets down to. I don't think people were making that connection. I think really what it was is just you had younger folks who have never lived through anything other than the tail end of the financial crisis, now in kind of senior roles in their industry, and they've just never seen a period outside of this free money period we've been living in. And so they're having difficulty adjusting to a new set of expectations. This is another challenge that the appraisers have. The appraisers, I kind of feel sorry for the appraisers because, you know, they're doing something. They're trying to come up with an honest estimate of the value. And the information is just so limited. And the experience set that they can draw from is so limited. When the central bank started raising rates, the rate rises for the Bank of Canada, the last time they raised rates as quickly as they did in this cycle was in the mid-1970s. I mean, look around at the conference here. Do you see anybody here who was appraising assets in the 1970s? There's just not that institutional memory in place of what you do with this kind of stuff. And honestly, there's not a lot of data from that period either. This is something when I've been meeting all my colleagues at MSCI and the other asset classes and talking with them about our information, and they're not condescending, but they're sort of, you know, friendly about it. Like, oh, okay, yeah, it's a cute little asset class. And here's some information. You know, it's, but boy, they have so much more information in the public equity markets and the bond markets. Daily pricing of everything. It's just mind-boggling, the amount of computer power just to manage data sets. It's almost frightening.
Yeah, we use just value per door, yeah, per square foot value, right? Okay, good.
Here's a spreadsheet with all our comparables.
Three trades with different per square foot, and you're just kind of using your gut instinct, adjust them up and down to come into your value, right?
I know. Our information set really started to get better in the mid-1980s for our industry, you know, just with personal computers coming about, people started to get more organized. There was data going back. People knew what they were doing from the 20s to the 60s. There were surveys. You know, you go back to some of the old BOMA reports. People were doing things. It's just they didn't have an easy way of recording it, getting into a database, getting it organized where people could use it again and again. And so there's not a real good data set that appraisers can look at to make sense of, well, how did people react to interest rate increases in the 1970s, and how did asset values change on that? So they're a little bit in uncharted territory. And so it's, so I feel a little bit bad for the appraisers because they've got the information available. It's harder to make a decision in this kind of environment.
And written proof for everybody pointing fingers at the end to say you got it wrong.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so that makes it also, you know, people will be hesitant to move. Because, again, the reputational risk of the person who moved too quickly or moved too slowly, that's the challenge in this asset class.
I like the, I don't like, it's interesting your comment about just the inexperience. And, you know, I'll put myself in there. I'm 41. So Adam, you know, same age-ish, mid-40s, 16, 17 years in the industry, but literally have never seen a cycle. Like I started, you know, effectively in the financial crisis in 2008. So I started at the beginning of the cycle and now seeing my first reset. Maybe being a lender, I'm perhaps a little bit more exposed to the risk because, you know, we just think of, you know, very sort of conservative terms, right? Lenders, you know, the objective is never to lose a dollar. We look at things, and you talked about these lower interest rates, and we have these conversations with clients, and certainly they kind of say, you know, they kind of dream about the days of yesteryear when I could finance my building at a 2.5% interest rate. And they kind of go, yeah, that would be nice if it would come back down there. That way the 3.5 cap that I bought the building at would still make sense. And we do this as lenders, kind of, okay, well, if inflation, where's inflation going to be? Well, let's call it 2, right? You're the economist, follow the math here, right? Let's say inflation stabilizes at 2. Historically, bond yields, T-bills, GOC, Government of Canada bonds trade, what, 100 basis points, 150 basis points wider than inflation? So all of a sudden you're talking risk-free bonds at, I don't know, call it 3.5-4%. And then your mortgage rate is another spread of 100 to 200 over top of that. So you're talking about a mortgage rate of 5-6% in a very stable environment, which I think is a healthy number. We've just been so spoiled as a result of the amount of liquidity due to the QE and everything else that was going on in this cycle, to believe that 2%, 3%, 4% interest rates for mortgages was reality, which it was, right, for a very short period of time. 5.5-6% interest rate, I think, is pretty good.
I mean, in the long scope of things, that is pretty good. But there is one challenge with that level. It's not just the experience that people had only working from the financial crisis on that's been a challenge. Even the older folks in the room here are also working now in an environment that's different than the past. From the mid-1980s until around 2019, anytime you bought a building, person who bought it maybe 7 years earlier, typical holding period for institutional quality properties tends to be maybe 7 years, 10 years, something like that. But over that whole period, interest rates are always falling. So on that kind of a time frame, if you held something for 7 to 10 years,
it was appreciating
just because of the interest rate environment changing over the interim time period. Because we had this massive inflationary spike in the late 70s globally. And then interest rates went up to record high levels, and they've been coming down since. And then we kind of hit a low level in the middle of the financial crisis, and rather in the middle of the COVID crisis, getting my crises mixed up there. And now we're resetting, but we're resetting at a level where it's like, okay, you know, it's still down from where it was. And this is going to be different than the past, because in the past, you always had the wind in the past, meaning everybody in our industry in our room here, they're doing deals. They always had the wind at their back in terms of capital values and the reduction in an interest rate environment. Not so much moving forward. So now if you're dealing with those borrowers and you're putting all the numbers together, also be asking the question, do I think that this person has the wherewithal to drive the income growth that they're suggesting? Because that's going to be an important component of returns moving forward.
Yeah.
And an important component of whether someone can actually pay off a loan in the future.
Yeah, balloon risk. Balloon risk is a new term. There's a lot of people in our industry that don't know what balloon risk is, yet if you're around in the 70s and 80s, you know, that was a major consideration when you were funding, is what's the chance that, you know, this person can afford the loan at the end of the term. We haven't had that issue because you funded at a 75% loan to value and it was at 50% loan to value by the time the loan matured, right? That's just the way it works.
Everybody underwriting has been nothing but sunshine for, you know, for almost decades at this point. I was at a NAIOP event and somebody was retiring. I wish I could remember who. This is a couple of years ago, but somebody very senior. And his message to the crowd of several hundred people was, don't mistake a tailwind for a good strategy. That was after decades of the business, was his message to everybody is, you're not as smart as you think you are. Everybody's doing well, but there's just been a, you know, a hurricane blowing behind you for 10 years straight.
Right.
And so,
so that's a really good point. I want to get your take on this, Jim, because this is unique. Well, it's unique because it's every cycle is different. Every crisis is slightly different. Not that this is a crisis, but you know what I mean? The fundamentals are broken and they're resetting. What's interesting to me, and we see it on the debt side for years, there's been a lot of people realizing the benefit of these tailwinds and recapitalizing their portfolio. There's a ton of people that have taken out a ton of money and not necessarily redeployed it, because just the way it worked, they took out a bunch of capital, maybe refinancing some assets, and then the market shifted, and so they haven't redeployed it. So I think there are a ton of players sitting on a ton of cash. Like, this is not a liquidity issue, right? There's a lot of money, but there's still no transactions going on. How do you balance the fact that there is a ton of money in the system, but just nothing transpiring?
Yeah, you know, the way people usually talk about that issue, they talk about the dry powder that's out there. Yeah, you know, how much dry powder? And there's been an argument that, well, we're not going to see too much of a calamity because there's so much dry powder. People are going to come in off the sidelines and buy everything. And I mean, if you follow that analogy, dry powder, once there's a breeze, it just blows away. Yeah, you know, because we saw that after the financial crisis, the same argument was in place then, that we weren't going to have big price declines because there was dry powder out there and it was going to jump on everything. It was going to keep prices from falling, but it didn't. And it just didn't, because the money was there for sure, but the investment opportunity just didn't make sense. You know, nobody was willing to pay, you know, the high prices of the past just to be able to deploy the money, because it was better just to hold on to it and wait for the market to reset, as opposed to chase the deals at the prices that still didn't give up enough to make the investments make sense. And so today, we don't have enough information yet in terms of distress that's been realized to just see the impact of those numbers, of the amount of the dry powder out there yet. And we're still, in some sense, at early stages of the market coming to grips with what's happening here. But you know, some anecdotal stuff I've heard from people, just some note sales. It seems that the larger notes that have been selling at a bit of a discount, you know, a little bit of distressed debt, that there is some reduction in price, but not entirely, because there still is a bit of a crush of capital looking for something. So I don't know. It looks like it's going to help some, but not as much as people hope.
If patience is a virtue?
Oh, yeah, always. Because, you know, if being the first person in and jumping in trying to buy distressed stuff or trying to buy even a cash flowing asset thinking the market has fully reset, that's a risky proposition sometimes from a reputational point of view. Again, nobody wants to be the person that everyone talks about 5 years from now at the global forum, that they were the one who bought everything at the record high prices before the final shoe fell.
Especially as so many people are managing other people's money, you know, particularly embarrassing.
Exactly.
Can we talk about the U.S. a little bit more? I mean, I know you mentioned that U.S. is the, you know, the gold mine for data, you know, due to, I guess, debt transparency and, you know, the size of the market. And we'll just use the general concept that generally what happens in the States gets mirrored here. What do you see transpiring in the States over the next, 24 months?
Yeah, this issue of transparency on the debt markets, the issue is that there's a wider variety of lenders in the United States than in other countries. There's been a challenge for us this year, actually. The Silicon Valley Bank and the stress that we saw from just the banking sector broadly, it raised a lot of questions for folks. Relative to the size of the economy, the U.S. has many more banks than other countries. Most countries have a handful of big champions, and the U.S. has a bunch of small specialty banks. You'll have banks focused on just certain types of agricultural loans. You have banks focused on just commercial real estate loans, banks focused on just lending to the oil sector. You name an industry, there's some specialty bank providing capital to it. And the competition from all that, plus the way public information gets managed outside of government sources, meaning our land title process, it just makes for a more transparent market than the rest of the world. It's not some bureaucrat kind of preventing information, hoarding information. It's private markets trying to make a living, collecting information and selling it. And so it makes it a bit more transparent there. That's been something we've been doing ourselves on the equity side, but the debt market, we rely on a lot of public sources and semi-public sources that are available in the U.S. and aren't available anyplace else. So we do have a sample in the United States, and maybe there's some stories that work there that people can take away to look at, what's happening in their own countries. And really, the distress that we're seeing right now, it's office buildings. We've seen an uptick in the last couple quarters of distressed office loans. There's a rise in delinquent loans, and delinquent meaning missing payments and people telling the owner that they're going to give the keys back. Maybe they won't. Maybe that's just a negotiating position as they're trying to reset things. But eventually some of that's going to flow through to defaults and REO situations for the lenders. And that has been rising in the last few quarters. It's not at the levels that we're at during the aftermath of the financial crisis yet. We're not that high in terms of the amount of distressed activity, but it is on the way up. It's as if people were waiting. Everybody has known for a while that there's a challenge with offices, but how much of a loss you should take and how much of a loss you should try and convince your lender to take. That's been the thing that everybody has not really made some moves on yet, but it seems like they're starting to move. We haven't calculated. It's a shame I'm here today as opposed to a few weeks now. We're in the middle of doing some calculations on the loans that did go bad and what kind of loss rates we're seeing. Maybe we could talk about that in November when I'm back here for the forum.
Yeah. You talk about office. What about other asset classes?
The hotels early in the crisis, in the COVID crisis, were a big source of defaults. Some of it was just bad timing. Well, full service hotels focused on convention center activity that happened to have a loan rolling over in 2020. What do you do? Nobody's making loans on those. There was no certainty of what happened in the future. So some of them, it was just bad timing. But the sector is doing better now. Some of that flushed its way out. And, it's not fully back everywhere. Some of the big urban markets that had a lot of conferences, people aren't coming back quite the same way. Although there's a lot of tourism too. So the hotel people I talk to talk about how the room night stays are different. It's not the business in the middle of the week. It's much more of a weekend kind of thing going on. So there's some changes there. But beyond hotel and office, those have been the main ones. There's some retail distress, but there was always some retail distress.
That's an American phenomenon, right? Like the retail per capita is just drastically larger than, at least in Canada, and I think anywhere else in the world.
No, it's higher in the United States. The ICSC has some studies that have shown on this that square foot per capita in the United States is higher than any place else in the world. And part of it is just the planning controls were non-existent. And we built an awful lot in various cycles over time. Plus, we have a lot that was built in places where it's just no longer needed. Forget about overbuilding. It's under demand in some areas, like the Rust Belt of the United States. When people talk about dead malls, that's where they are. It's the Columbus, Ohio, or Cleveland, a mall that was built in an industrial town in the 60s or 70s, with like orange carpet and burnt brown tile, selling polyester pants to manufacturing workers. That mall is dead, not because the internet has taken away the sales, but because the local personal disposable income from the manufacturing workers is gone because those jobs are gone. And so there's the malls get painted with a broad, bad picture because of some of these assets in bad locations. So you've got that as a kicker as well. But Canada, you had a better situation with a more, from the perspective of current owners, a better situation of more restrictive zoning controls. And so planning controls and everything, so you don't have as much competition.
The one positive thing about the zoning in Canada.
It's good when you are the incumbent, but it's bad for developers and it's bad for competition. So there's got to be a happy medium between the two. Personally, I think of, you know, some sort of market-based incentives, you know, maybe zoning through charging fees around highest and best use, but that's a whole other thing.
It's a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
We're almost out of time, Jim. So, you know, given we're in this sort of transitioning cycle, what's your crystal ball look like? What's the general time frame? How bad does it get? What are you thinking?
Well, one thing that I think is just hardwired, we're going to start to see in the fourth quarter of this year and the first quarter of 2024, the declines in deal volume we've seen recently have been at high double digits. That's going to start to moderate. And part of it is that we've seen really bad headline figures for deal volume in recent months, simply because a year ago, things were still looking good. We still had, you know, low interest rates early in 2022. Deal volume continued at record high levels for a bit. We had an excess period of liquidity for a bit. And so the headline numbers today have looked bad because
year over year
looks bad. But we're going to start getting into that period where, okay, we've been in a high interest rate environment for a year now. But I think that's also going to, and so the deal volume isn't going to be falling as much. But I think it's also going to allow people to start to come to grips with how they should be valuing things. It's been a year of high interest rates, you know, higher than where they were. And I think people who have been holding out, usually in our sector, takes about a year for this kind of information to filter through to investment committees, to communicating to your investors where things stand, to going to conferences and talking with everybody and figuring out where all the desire lines lie in the capital sources.
Going on podcasts.
That's where information comes through. And which also for my public market colleagues at MSCI, they find funny in a sense, like, what, you go talk to people to figure out where things are at? It's like, well, yeah, this is real estate. It's an opaque market. You have to talk to everybody.
How it works.
Yeah.
I think we're out of time. Jim, thanks so much for joining us. We didn't nail down how many times you've been on, but I know it's not your last. So that will be maybe interesting to get you back on when you're next landed in Toronto. We, of course, want to thank First National for powering the podcast, Granite REIT for sponsoring the video series, and most of all, our guest, Jim. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the CRE podcast. The information from this broadcast is not to be relied upon as financial investing, professional accounting, or legal advice. First National Financial LP holds Financial Services Commission of Ontario License Number 10514 and 11252.